U of I was like hard to get into mechanical engineering school. So like my expectation was this was going to be like the best of the best. And like I wasn't by no means like the best person in my high school class, right? Like it was hard to win those things. And I literally got laughed off the front of the room. My team was embarrassed that those were the ideas. It got so rowdy, the TA had to basically stop my presentation and say, please sit down. You're disturbing class. So then we launched it, and obviously it flew in the air, right? So it went like at least 10 times farther than the second place person. The TA didn't know what to say, and he went back into the basement of the building and bought me a Snickers bar.
Welcome back to the Make or Break show, where each week we bring you stories of incredible makers and the make or break moments that have defined them along the way. I'm your host, Brandon Cullum, and this week we chat with Zach Kaplan, the CEO of Inventables. We get into how he built his company and how he's bringing big business style manufacturing into your garage with their line of CNC machines. What is up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the Make or Break show. This is a really fun one we've had on the books for quite a while now. We get to interview the one and only Zach Kaplan, who is the brain and CEO behind Inventables, the super popular CNC company, home of the X-Carve and the Carvey and a bunch of other cool things. And it's a fun one. But before we get into that, we want to remind you guys, as always, that the show is brought to you by the wonderful supporters over on Patreon. You guys are absolutely amazing. Thank you so much for helping out each week. And if you guys would like to support the show, you can head over to patreon.com/makeorbreakshow. There's a bunch of cool things you guys can get, including I will carve out something on my own X-Carve CNC that is from Inventables, and that is one of the rewards levels. So you guys can check all those out over on Patreon. And another announcement that is going alongside of this interview, like I said, the Inventables, they are the guys behind the X-Carve and Carvey, which are great CNC machines. And I recently got my own X-Carve over the Christmas break. This was not, they didn't give it to me. They didn't sponsor anything. This was just straight up. I paid for it. And it was the, it's kind of their medium size one, the 750 millimeter. And I've been using it a lot lately to produce signs, specifically like football stadium signs that you can put on your wall and sell. So I'm going to try to create a little bit of a side business with that and selling them. And I'm going to document that process for you guys. But the cool part about this is you really get into the world of bits. There's all different types of bits you get once you get into machining, whether they're V-carve bits, end mills, roundovers, all kinds of crazy stuff. And to go alongside with this episode, we are partnering with Tools Today, who are the providers of amazing bits, including I've got a 60 degree V-carve that I bought that is killing it in my shop right now. And we've got a bunch of different bits as well as some blades that you guys can win if you guys head over to makeorbreakshop.com/giveaway, or there is a link in the show notes. And even if you guys do not have a CNC machine, we have two different levels. There's one for people who have CNCs, and there is one who for people who do not. So they're giving away a lot of really cool ones, and they are the kind of the industry standard. They provide a lot of great bits from a lot of the great companies out there in kind of the CNC and maker space. So be sure and check that out. This is going to be going for a couple weeks. You guys will hear about it next week as well. But there's a bunch of ways you guys can get extra entries. So be sure and jump over and check it out. All right, so getting into this interview with Zach, like I said, I got my very first CNC machine over the Christmas break. I was super excited to put it together. It's kind of like a kit build, so it takes a little while. But if you guys really enjoy Legos and all that kind of stuff, that's kind of how I viewed it, just an adult size. And I wanted to get into it so much so that my wife had to tell me, you can't start messing with this thing until you get all these other projects done, which were Christmas presents. So that gave me a lot of motivation before getting this thing built. But if you guys do not know what a CNC is, it stands for Computer Numerical Control. You guys have probably seen them online before over on Instagram or in people's YouTube videos. But if you haven't, imagine a router that is attached to a X and Y and Z coordinate, kind of like a gimbal that just moves it across. So a lot of signs get made this way. There's a lot of 3D carving that can happen this way, but the computer creates the coordinates and it sends it to the computer on board the CNC, and then it carves it out with a router. And in my case, I have an X-Carve and it has a, like a DeWalt router that's attached to it. A lot of times the bigger ones have their custom spindles that do really cool things. And so what's cool about this is this technology has been around for a really long time, but you would really only find it in the big manufacturing areas, people creating just big parts at a massive scale. And so you haven't really seen it in kind of the DIY maker space. And so Shapeoko, which is actually Invendible started out using their technology, and even though they're separate companies now, they're kind of the other player in the space. They are kind of bringing that technology into your garage or into your room or wherever you guys are making stuff. And so we get into Zach's kind of vision for the future, where kind of the development of this came from and where he sees his company going. Zach is great. He is big in the maker community. He, along with a bunch of other guys, are kind of on the forefront of creating tools that we all love using. So without further ado, let's jump into our interview with Zach. We want to welcome you guys back to the Make or Break show. We're hanging out with the one and only Zach Kaplan, the CEO of Invendibles. Colin, in you're in Chicago, is that right?
Yep.
Cool. We're excited to have you on. I know a lot of the folks that listen to this are getting into more of the maker side of things from straight woodworkers. And so a lot of that, especially is CNC and getting into the cool things that you can build with that. And so I know a lot of people are super excited to hear what you guys are doing now and in the future. But thank you so much for jumping on and chatting with me.
Awesome. Happy to be here.
So I'd love to get into your background a little bit. And I think I was listening to a talk you gave. And you mentioned when you were growing up that you built a roller coaster.
Yeah.
Like a model roller coaster.
Yeah. So I got into digital manufacturing actually in high school.
Okay.
And my freshman year, they started this program called SciTech, which combined the manual shop, traditional tools like the mills and lathes that were in the high school to teach the trades and vocations, with a physics teacher who brought in all the computer and digital side and all the engineering and the more math-based approach. And that, back when I went to high school, they called that SciTech.
Oh, cool.
And junior and senior year in that class, I built a scale model roller coaster. It's 10 foot by 12 foot and 5 feet tall.
Good Lord. Okay.
And it was made out of steel.
So were you... were you the kid then that was always kind of making stuff even before that class? Like, were you always into especially like physical construction and engineering?
Oh yeah.
That's cool. So you said that it was 5 feet tall, the coaster?
Yeah.
So did you ever try to ride it, or like, did anyone like small, like did you ever put like an animal on or anything like that?
You could put like a G.I. Joe type size person,
but human. Okay. Gotcha. Ride
it. Yeah. No, in real life it would be 200 feet tall. So it was scaled down from a 200 footer.
Gotcha. Were you basing that off of like a current roller coaster, or?
I actually designed it to be as tall as the Magnum at Cedar Point in Sandusky, Ohio. But it was my own design in terms of like the layout, and I did it in a program called Coaster.
Oh, cool! Yeah,
and then exported the CAD and basically just broke it down into sections, so it fits together kind of like a train set does with each of the pieces of track sliding into each other. But there's obviously only one way you can assemble it because it's made out of steel.
Yeah, yeah. So was the steel, were they like welded together, or were you able to get like steel parts that would like fit in together, kind of like Legos?
No, so it's 3/8 inch mild steel rails. And then I bent them. So remember in geometry class, they had those massive protractors?
Like yeah.
So we use those to figure out the angles of each of the pieces of track, and we bent them in using a rolling machine.
Okay, cool.
And then welded the braces. You know how like there's like braces holding the two rails together on a roller coaster? So then we welded the braces to each of the tracks on the outside, and then the car runs basically on the top and the bottom of the track.
That's cool. I was not thinking that that intense, especially getting into welding and stuff. Is that something that you still have?
The coaster?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool. So did you want to like design roller coasters and stuff? Was that something you were thinking down the line? This would be a cool occupation.
Yeah. Build an amusement park. That's what I was focused on.
That's awesome. I played the game Roller Coaster Tycoon a ton growing up. And so I was always trying to build digital roller coasters, but never got into the physical side of things. But okay, so you went to University of Illinois for mechanical engineering. Is that right?
Yeah. So that experience in SciTech and building that roller coaster got me very interested in mechanical engineering.
And was it still going towards the theme park, that type of design stuff, even when you were in college, or did things kind of shift for you and kind of where you saw your career going?
No, that's actually where I the original major that I had was called Leisure Studies, which was essentially the management of amusement parks.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I transferred into mechanical engineering. I think in the middle of freshman year.
What made you switch to mechanical?
I figured if I did mechanical engineering, I could always go back and do business or amusement park management. But if I did amusement park management or business, I couldn't go back and do mechanical engineering.
Yeah. So were you always then kind of the math and science kid as well? Like, was that something that kind of came natural to you?
I don't know if it came natural, but I was definitely interested in it.
Okay. So were you, I did aerospace engineering in college. So I had a lot of friends that were mechanical and I felt like they got to play with like the things that moved. A lot of my stuff was just all computers because we couldn't like build like a full scale rocket. So were there any cool like shop classes? Did you guys do any design competitions with mechanical?
Unfortunately, when I went to University of Illinois, there was very few hands-on experiences. The program was, I think, started or at least the shaped in the 50s, and it was designed for people going to work at places like General Motors, like in the automotive industry or Caterpillar.
Gotcha.
It was on the early parts of like this new wave of hardware.
Yeah.
I think now they definitely have a lot more hands-on experiences. But for me, there's only like one hands-on project the whole time.
Yeah. What'd you work on?
It was the black box project, they called it.
Okay.
And it was a 2 foot, the criteria, they're like, you can make a 2 foot by 2 foot box and there's going to be two holes on the same plane of the box.
Okay.
The TA is going to put in a matchbox car into one of the holes and then it has to come out the other hole. And the distance, like the longer the distance, the higher your grade, and it's going to be graded on a curve. That was basically the brief. The only other criteria was you could not use electricity.
Okay.
And you could not touch the box. Like the TA just puts the car in and then it comes out. Like there's no touching or like interacting with the box after you set it down.
So, I mean, is it all, you're working pretty much with gravity? Is that the only thing that you really can work with?
They didn't say that. They just said okay. You couldn't use electricity.
Gotcha. So what'd you do?
Well, first I'll tell you what every other team did.
Okay.
So actually, it was 4 out of the 6 teams, they built a ramp. So like you said, gravity. Yeah. So you put it in one and then it rolled down and then went out the other one. So those folks got, I think, somewhere between like 6 and 11 feet, depending on the quality of the ramp.
Okay.
And then there's one guy who, he did that, but he added a mouse trap. So he like did it upside down. So the mouse trap essentially slapped the car.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
As it went by.
Yeah.
And he got like 15 feet or something like that. And we were running these in the hallway in the engineering building. And most people built their boxes out of cardboard, which makes sense.
Yeah.
So I had just done this SciTech class for like 4 years. So this kind of project was kind of in my wheelhouse. This wasn't like my first time at the rodeo here.
Yeah.
So instead of cardboard, I built mine out of 2x4s. And since you couldn't use electricity, I knew a ramp wasn't going to win. So I put a potato cannon in my box.
in a 2 foot box?
Yeah, okay. 2 foot by 2 foot. So it was a modified, like a short barrel potato cannon.
Okay.
And you couldn't touch it. So I got a Coleman lantern starter, which like it winds and creates the spark.
Yeah.
And then I welded a mouse trap to like the lantern starter. And then I went to this store called Meijer. It's kind of like a Walmart, and got a board game that had a wind up timer.
Yeah.
And I epoxied a plastic knife to the face of the wind up timer.
Okay.
So I told the TA, I'm like, we can't run mine in the hallway. We have to go outside. And he's like, okay. So we went outside in front of the building. So I like wind up the timer. I set it down and I'm like, okay. And I had the potato preloaded in there.
Okay.
With the propane and everything. I was like, okay, go ahead and put the car in. And I had a series of PVC that basically the car fell in and was just sitting there in front of the potato. And then when the timer went off, it basically turned, like the knife hit the mousetrap, which turned the fulcrum on the Coleman lantern starter.
Yeah.
Which ignited the spark, which launched the potato. So I got like 180 feet.
What was everyone's reaction? Did anyone else other than your team like know this thing's like pretty much going to explode and shoot this thing out?
So it's funny. When we had to give presentations, like I think like the halfway point. And I was expecting, you know, lots of challenging ideas like that, just because of my experience in high school. And like, U of I was like hard to get into mechanical engineering school. So like my expectation was this was going to be like the best of the best. Right. Right? And like, I wasn't by no means like the best, person in my high school class. Right. Like it was hard to win those things. And I literally got laughed off the front of the room. My team was embarrassed that those were the ideas, and it got so rowdy that the TA had to basically stop my presentation and say, please sit down. You're disturbing class.
Huh.
So I was like, okay. So then we launched it, and obviously it flew in the air, right? So yeah. it went like at least 10 times farther than the second place person. The TA didn't know what to say, and he went back into the basement of the building and bought me a Snickers bar.
That's awesome. That is nuts. Yeah, that's real surprising. That most of the things were a ramp. Did you approach your other projects kind of in that same mindset? Like, have you always found yourself kind of more in the traditional, not traditional, but more the real world manufacturing side of things versus kind of coming maybe from the conceptual computer side of things that maybe the other folks do mechanical work?
I don't know. Like, I mean, I've always loved building stuff and tinkering around. I don't know why in that particular class that was my approach and other people took a more traditional approach. Yeah. I think, honestly, it was like that class in high school really gave me a set of experiences that showed me, you know, how to think about those types of problems.
Right.
And if you're going to win, you couldn't just do what the obvious first answer to the problem was going to be. You know, I had 4 years of that class.
Oh, wow. Okay. Gotcha.
So it was, sometimes we even got him to come in on the weekends and work on this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so it was like pretty much in my wheelhouse by the time I got to freshman year.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you graduated, was kind of the traditional, like you mentioned, General Motors, mechanical engineering, was that the route that you were going to take next?
No, I knew. Well, that's not true. Freshman year. So I actually got an internship at General Motors.
Okay, cool.
And what that taught me, that taught me a lot of things, but one of the things I learned was I did not want to work full-time at General Motors.
Yeah.
And so the second summer, I got an internship at this company called Yaskawa. They're a motion control company. And so at General Motors, I was working on a turbocharger for a locomotive.
Okay.
And then at Yaskawa, I was working on mechatronics. Basically, they made motion controllers. And our project that summer was called a rotary flying cutoff. So it was like a machine that cut the packaging for candy bars, like perfectly in between the two candy bars.
Okay.
As the candy bars were getting sealed. So basically it's a knife that like sort of spins around in an elliptical fashion and then slices the registration indicator on the candy bar wrapper goes over a sensor, which activates the knife, which then cuts it perfectly every time.
Yeah.
That was my project sophomore year. So I knew after that experience that I wanted to do something that was more like with mechatronics or software combining with hardware as opposed to just pure mechanical engineering.
And Jesse, you also, did you start Leverworks, is that right? The software development while you were in college?
Yeah. So I sort of got this idea that I wanted to start my own company in college. I think even in high school, I think I told my parents I wanted to drop out and start my own company.
Yeah.
And they asked me, well, what kind of company? And I said, I don't know. And they said, well, why don't you go back to high school? I was very frustrated about that. But yeah, so the idea, I can't exactly remember the complete origin story of Leverworks, but I knew in the back of my head, one of my goals was by the time I graduated, I wanted to be making as much money with Leverworks as I would have made had I taken the full-time job at General Motors.
Gotcha. Okay.
So I started, I think it was like mid-junior year. And then got serious with it senior year.
And so was it consulting? What were you guys doing?
Yeah, we were doing PHP websites, essentially.
Okay.
So building like shopping carts and content management systems. The biggest customer we had was this company called Flexengate, who makes 80% of all the bumpers for trucks and SUVs. And we did an engineering change notice system for them.
Okay, gotcha. So once you graduated, was it, how did you kind of get to Inventables from there? Was that kind of your next step?
No, so when I graduated, my full-time job was working at Leverworks.
Okay.
But Leverworks got bought out December of after graduation, so 6 months after graduating.
Okay.
And then started Inventables the next year.
What do you think about you has kind of the desire to start your own thing, or maybe even go against the norm, even going back to the class in college? Has that just been a trait that's kind of been natural to you?
I was just trying to realize my maximum potential. And at the time, I thought that starting my own company would be the best way to do that.
So when you started Inventables, was it originally around the idea of bringing kind of CNC manufacturing to more the everyday user?
No. So my experience at General Motors taught me that as a mechanical engineer in a large organization like that, you get to focus on a very narrow set of problems.
Okay.
And what I started thinking about is where was I most excited, or where did I want to spend all my time? And for me, it was more on a diverse set of problems. And I was interested in the product development process. So there's this company called IDEO that's a design consultancy.
Yeah.
And at the time, they had just had this Nightline episode where they redesigned a shopping cart. And so I became very interested in IDEO. And they had this thing called the Tech Box, which was essentially like a Craftsman tool chest full of different materials and technologies.
Okay.
And approached IDEO and said, hey, can we commercialize the Tech Box? And they sort of said, that's an interesting idea. Go ahead and do it, but just don't use our name. We'll sort of partner with you from a knowledge sharing perspective.
Okay.
So we would do like a call with their Tech Box curators once a month or something, once a quarter, something like that. And then came up with the name Inventables, and it was a subscription. So the product that we sold was a subscription to, it was a quarterly subscription. So you basically signed up, paid your money, and then every quarter we sent you 20 new materials and technologies.
Oh, cool. Okay.
And our customers were the R&D and industrial design groups of places like Procter & Gamble and Nike and Black & Decker. And they were tasked with not thinking about what product are we going to launch next year, but what product are we going to launch in 3 years or 5 years? That's who we were usually working with.
Gotcha. Okay.
So you guys were almost like the supplier to all these big companies, R&D labs, like with the new things that are coming out. Is that kind of the idea?
Yeah.
Okay. That's cool. What then kind of brought you towards, I know, Shapeoko and CNC from there? Like, was that something you guys did for several years with that subscription?
Yeah. So we did that from 2002 to about 2009.
Okay. Gotcha. Wow.
Sort of at the end of 2008 and 2009, a bunch of things started happening. So one is the economy crashed at the end of 2008 because of the housing crisis.
Yeah.
And all of these web platforms had started launching. So there's like Kickstarter. So there's the first $1 million Kickstarter, which was done by Scott Wilson. And we actually knew Scott prior to that Kickstarter because he was our customer at Nike. Scott ran the timing and tech lab at Nike.
Oh, cool. Okay.
And designed those Nike watches that like were sort of on an angle.
Yeah.
So he left Nike and the Kickstarter was for it was a watch band for the iPod Nano.
Okay.
And when I saw that, I was like, whoa, you don't need the client anymore. That was like the first thought that went in my head, because typically the design firms were hired by the client, who would be like Nike. They would do the design, hand it over to the company, and the company would make the investment to go do it. But Scott essentially just did the whole thing on his own because he got the $1 million in pre-funding. And at the time, like $1 million in pre-funding, like the average Kickstarter was like 10 or 15 grand, right? So it was this like watershed moment in my head, like, wow, okay, that's different. Etsy also started to get some scale. Shopify came out so you could get your own store for like $20 a month or something like that.
Yeah.
Amazon in 06 launched Fulfillment by Amazon. So by 09, it started to become a thing that people were familiar with. And so all of a sudden, there was enough of these software platforms that you could essentially start and run your own business and use social media to attract customers. And that was new for like the first time in the history of the world, right? Like that you could start a business for essentially like under $1,000, right?
Yeah.
And not just a business like, oh, I started this home-based business, but like a business that you could make real money at. And so I saw that stuff happening, and I saw a bunch of people trying to launch or do essentially like seed funding for more venture capital style businesses on Kickstarter, but doing it before getting venture capital. And I was like, man, our customers in these Fortune 500 companies are signing up to Inventables for innovation, right? Because they want to launch the next new product that's going to bring them additional margin dollars. Except it's extremely hard to do that in a Fortune 500 company. Like the inertia of the Fortune 500 company is they want to do incremental improvements on what's already working, as opposed to a radical innovation for something completely new.
Right. The whole like innovator's dilemma situation.
Yeah. So Clay Christensen wrote a whole book on that. But these small startups, like they're not encumbered by the success of the status quo. So they just do it. And I was like, wow, if the core mission of Inventables is to help these companies innovate, and like the innovation is not going to come from these big companies, it's going to come from all these small guys, then I just felt like we have to shift the focus for how we're getting paid. And in 2009, I decided to raise some venture capital and essentially flip the business. Instead of focusing on these big companies that were doing R&D, focus on making everything we were doing for big companies accessible to every small company and do it over the web.
Okay. So was that transition then, as far as income, were you guys still thinking the same product idea, like still providing this same type of like quarterly resources just to a different market, or is it a total different solution that you guys were coming with?
Yeah. So we were actually getting contacted by lots of startups and smaller businesses over the internet prior to making the full switch. And initially, instead of doing the subscription, like the small businesses are like, well, I just need it now. The idea was we were just going to put all of the information on the web that we had under login and password. And instead of publishing the contact information for the vendor, we would just essentially sell the information on demand as you needed it. So it was sort of like selling a lead to the vendor.
Okay.
And on the buy side, we were getting tons of people who were interested in connecting. But on the sell side, the vendors were unwilling to pay for the leads. And so I would call up the vendor and be like, you know, because they would get like a inquiry and say like, Nike is interested in 200,000 units of this foam, whatever, like $50 to get his contact information. And the vendor would be like, no, thanks. And I would call him up and be like, "What? Why are you not interested in paying $50 for this contact to Nike?" And he would say something like, well, if the guy at Nike wants to buy the foam, just give him my number and have him place an order. So I was like trying to explain like the whole lead thing. So eventually we just got rid of the leads and just put up the materials and said like, okay, fine. If you want to buy it, like just go ahead and buy it.
Yeah.
Because the buyers, they had a fistful of dollars and they were like willing to buy it now. Like they didn't care about the vendor. Like they just wanted the stuff because they're like, I'm working on my project. I just need this material. So the leads gave way to essentially just selling all the materials.
Okay. So from there, how did you get involved with Shapeoko and that? The Kickstarter was 2011, is that right? Somewhere around there?
Yeah, something like that. Okay. I can't remember the exact date, but so we were selling. So at the time, the Fab Lab that came out of MIT was starting to get some momentum, and we started adding acrylic to our catalog, to our warehouse. And acrylic was mostly used in the laser cutter. So I was like looking around like in Chicagoland who had a laser and trying to just reach out to them to let them know that we had this wide selection of colored acrylic sheets. So I was connecting with a bunch of people who had lasers, and I saw this website called buildlog.net that was run by this guy, Bart Dring, who had made an open source laser cutter. And I emailed him. It must have been at like 11 o'clock at night. And he wrote back in like 2 seconds. And we did a back and forth. And he asked me if I'd ever seen the MakerSlide project. And I hadn't. And I took a look at it, but I didn't understand. It just looked like some components. I didn't really understand what it was. And he said, well, are you going to be up at the Maker Faire in Detroit? And I said, yeah. He's like, okay, let's just meet up. So I met up with him there. He was a really nice guy. He brought the MakerSlide. He was super excited about it. He showed me it was like a linear railing system. And I was like, that's cool. And then I invited him to this thing I run with Google called Ord Camp. It's O-R-D Camp.
Yeah, okay.
Which is like it's like an unconference. And he brought the OrdBot, which was a 3D printer that used the MakerSlide. And when I saw that machine, I was like, okay, I get it now. Like, super interesting. And he asked me, would you be interested in selling the MakerSlide in your store? And I was like, well, are you selling it now? And he's like, yeah, I keep selling out and I have a full-time job. So I would just prefer if you guys took over like the fulfillment and management of it. And at the time I was like, okay, I don't know if there's that many more people who want to buy MakerSlide. It seems like on the Kickstarter, you might have fulfilled all the demand. So we put this thing up on the site that said, essentially, if we got 500 pounds worth of MakerSlide or 500 sections, we would do it. But if we didn't, then everybody would get their money back. We wouldn't charge a card. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the Groupon. It was at that time the Groupon had just come out, so it's sort of like a Groupon style.
Gotcha.
Like when Groupon was actually Groupon and not just
Yeah.
And we did it, and the interesting thing was we sold enough MakerSlide on that crowdfunding, if you put the sticks of Makerslide end to end, they would go to the top of the Sears Tower. I guess today they call it the Willis Tower.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there was demand. And around that time, so I went over to Pumping Station One with Bart, and he introduced me to this guy, Edward Ford, who had just done a Kickstarter for the Shape Oko.
Okay.
And we were chatting, and Edward said, you know, would you be willing to put the machine up on the site with the Makerslide? And I said, sure, let's try it. I was really excited about it because of my experience in high school using like Mastercam and the CNC machines that they had in high school. But those machines were super expensive, right? Like the original Shape Oko, I think we sold it for like $599 or something like that. Mm-hmm. So that was like something that was like accessible in a way that, you know, an average person, if they wanted to figure out how to get the $600, they could do it. You know, sort of a mid-range computer costs $600. So that got me really excited.
So at that point, the Makerslide was separate from the Shape Oko. Is that right? Did I see it was almost like laser cut wood was kind of how it was constructed initially?
Yeah. So the original one in his video, if you go back and look at those videos, so Makerslide had its own Kickstarter.
Okay.
And in one of the updates, Bart essentially does a screencast showing how you could use the Makerslide to make a CNC machine. And the one he designs looks kind of like an X-Carve.
Yeah.
In that video. But yeah, I think originally the first prototype of the Shape Oko was wood. And he was using, I think those were like drawer slides.
Okay.
But then when he hooked up with Bart, started using the Makerslide as the railing system. And so for the Shape Oko 1, that's how it shipped. Or at least the first version that we sold, it shipped with the Makerslide as the railing system.
Gotcha. So the development of that, did you guys kind of see that was going to be a big seller or a big like emphasis of the company? Because I know like now when I go to Inventables, then the materials piece makes a lot more sense now. A lot of the focus is towards Carvey or X-Carve, and then you guys have a shop where you can buy materials, all that kind of stuff too. Was there a turning point for that? Did it shift or was it kind of a gradual transition?
It was definitely a gradual transition, and I did not expect that it was going to be the focus of the company. When we launched it.
Yeah.
Even after we had sold it for a little while, it wasn't totally clear. But yeah, gradually just over time, it became more and more obvious and it just became the focus.
One of the things that I keep coming back to is the software component. So Easel. I've played around with like the Universal G-Code Sender and VCarve and all like even Fusion. But a lot of the projects I do, I'm like, man, this thing is just so easy. And I can, like you mentioned a lot of times, in 5 minutes, get something created. Was software then, did you know that was something you guys really wanted to invest in and develop alongside of this?
Yeah. So we've always been interested in software. I mean, even before Inventables with LabWorks, software was a part of at least my background and experience. And I knew like, you know, so the original idea was like, could we find software that already existed to be able to run the machine in a more accessible or easier way? And that was really informed by my experience in high school with Mastercam.
Yeah.
Because you had to do CAD, like design your CAD. And I think in those days we were using AutoCAD and then import that into Mastercam, do the CAM, and then export the G-code and import that into the machine controller. So it's like three pieces of software. If you've ever done that, it's not straightforward, right? It's not like using PowerPoint, click. It requires training and a real good understanding of tool paths and how that works and et cetera. And as a high school kid, like that was frustrating, right? Like I didn't have patience for CAM. I just wanted to carve out my thing. So The original idea was like, hey, can we find a tool chain that already exists to do this? And we found this thing called MakerCam. It's just MakerCam.com. And I think it's still out there. And you could essentially open up an SVG and do the cam on it. And I initially thought that this solved the problem, right? It was relatively straightforward. It was in browser, it was free. And if you understood the mental model for toolpaths, you could easily do what you can do in Easel today relatively straightforward and relatively quickly. Mm-hmm. But if you were completely new to this whole field, then you were baffled, right? Like, what is a profile operation? What is a pocket operation? What is a toolpath? What does any of this mean?
Right.
I have my rectangle. I just want to carve out a pocket, or I just want to carve it out. Like, what do I have to do? And so after like observing enough of the people that like this wasn't obvious to them, I realized that there was an opportunity to just make a better software experience that more people could participate in. And so the next step actually is I went to Autodesk and I pitched them on partnering to work on this. And they had this product called the Autodesk CNC utility. I believe they've since shut it down, but I was never able to get enough interest on their side of it, and eventually just decided, okay, we're going to go do it ourselves.
So when did Easel first become available for people to start using?
We launched it at South by Southwest in 2014.
Okay. Gotcha. So was that alongside of Carvey then? Because that was Carvey's Kickstarter was October of 2014. Is that right?
Yeah, I think we launched it ahead of Carvey.
Okay. That's cool. Yeah, and it's for people that don't know. I mean, it's free to use. You guys have like pro features. Has the development of it been? Has it been what you initially thought it was going to turn into?
Yeah, I'd say that we have a long way to go. Like, we have big plans for Easel, but I'd say it's turning into what we hoped it would turn into.
Gotcha.
I think it's still very early for Easel.
Yeah.
But just in terms of order of magnitude, like this year, there will be over 2 million carves that go through Easel.
Jeez. Okay.
And over 4 million logins. So from a user adoption perspective, it's been tremendous. Like, I remember the first day that we had 1,000 carves in a day, and I was like, wow.
Yeah.
Like, that really struck me, like 1,000 in a day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just like, I don't know, it just seemed, at the time, it seemed like a lot.
Yeah.
But we're working on it every day, right? So software is, it's hard to do software.
Like, yeah.
You know, it looks easy because it's just software, but we've got like 7 people working on it every day. And it takes time.
Yeah. What's been maybe some of the crazier projects or some of the most memorable projects you guys have seen come through with those millions of carves and logins?
So this guy, Ben Ueda.
Yeah.
You know Ben? So he does some really crazy projects. So he did one, this like spiral staircase. Have you seen that one?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, I had been on the show probably a few months ago, and I think that video was coming out or really close to coming out. And then that thing just blew up everywhere. That was crazy.
That was crazy. Yeah. And then he just did a shoe store in Venice, California.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That I saw a few weeks ago in person, which was really cool to see in person. And I walked into the store and like everyone was basically just snapping pictures of it with their phone and posting on Instagram and stuff.
Yeah. 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 And it was all, is it plywood? Is that what he was using?
Yeah. Just plywood from Home Depot.
Yeah. And he just,
he used two X-Carve machines. He designed an Illustrator, imported into Easel. And then they had two machines carving it out like 8 hours a day.
Yeah. It's so, so wild. He makes such cool stuff and it's, the process is simple. It just takes a while.
Yeah.
That's cool. So, as we're kind of getting close to the end and wrapping up, where do you guys kind of see the future going? I know you guys have several different models of the X-Carve. You have Carvey, and then you have the resources you guys are providing through Easel and all the materials. Is it more of the same, just kind of developing those, or is there something kind of on the horizon you guys are interested in getting into?
Yeah, so what we've seen over time is more and more people making money with our tools. It started that, you know, in 2012, 2013, I would say most of the customers were hobbyists.
Yeah.
And most of the customers were just interested in building the machine for the fun of it and playing with it for the fun of it. Today, most of the customers are interested in making money. They're starting businesses. They're either full-time businesses or they're businesses where it's supplemental income for them. They might have a full-time job and then this is a way that they can make some extra cash. I talked to one guy, like he said that in his full-time job, he makes 40 grand and then he makes 40 grand off his X-Carve.
That's cool.
The Steve and Debbie, who they're on the homepage right now, Debbie was an accountant and she lost her job and she ended up buying the small X-Carve and started a sign business. She paid it back in 2 months. They now have two machines and her husband, Steve, has joined her in the business. And last year, I think they sold about 7,000 signs.
Good Lord. Okay.
So we're seeing more and more this pattern where people can get started with very low investment dollars.
Yeah.
And really just some hustle and effort. And they can start building a business that can be a source of income for them. And they're choosing to take it as far as they personally want. And so in response to that, like last year we launched Easel Pro and we have lots of features on the roadmap that we're working on. We're working on making Easel faster, more reliable, all focused around how do we help people make money with this.
Right.
But at the same time, we always want to make Easel accessible so you can be that high school kid or that person who has a full-time job and they just want to dabble. And so you can kind of get in there and get going without having to spend any money and have a lot of overhead.
Yeah. So with those customers being maybe more on, not the higher end, but maybe the higher end of how much they're using it, do you guys see more of like the larger machines, like the 4x8s or the 4x4s? Is that something you guys would be getting into as well in the future in terms of the actual like X-Carves or even the Carveys?
Maybe.
gotcha. That's cool. Well, I appreciate your time and chat with me. It's always a blast. And speaking to that sign thing, I posted something I was making in my house like the other day and I had like two people say, hey, can I just buy this? And I was like, yeah, sure. Why not? So definitely really easy to sell stuff that you're making when it's a product that's cool and easy to make. But thank you so much for the time and what you guys are doing. Looking forward to kind of seeing what's happening next for you guys.
Cool. Thanks.
And if for people that are interested, just inventables.com, either in the X-Carve or even you and the stuff that you guys are working on.
Yeah. Inventables.com or easel.com. That'll get you to the right place.
Good stuff. Well, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks.
All right, thanks for hanging around to the end. This is where I give you guys a quick update about the things that I have got going on in my shop. Like I mentioned at the top of the show, I am working on some CNC signs that are kind of the seating diagrams of football stadiums, especially down here in the South. It's about to hit football season, and I'm doing a lot of kind of local SEC stadiums that I'm going to try to sell. And so I'm going to make a video and kind of document that process. So right now I'm in the middle of just
creating a good product and then kind of putting together the storefront and figuring out how to drive traffic to it. So that is hopefully something I'm going to be able to put together so you guys can check it out and see some of the things I did right and I did wrong. If you are thinking about kind of having your own side hustle and making products, especially using these kind of computer controlled CNCs. And what's great about it is you can be doing other things while basically your army of robots are working for you, which is really cool. In addition to that, I might be a little bit quiet here in the next week or so after the 4th of July. Me and my family are going out to the Great Northwest up in Portland as well as Seattle on vacation. So I'll be out for about a week, but you guys still should see shows coming out in your feed where you have pre-recorded those. But over on Instagram, I might be a little quiet. And then after that, we're getting back with some fun projects, including this hopefully Swing X-Wing swing that I've been teasing. I've been working on the model of it recently and excited to get into it so my daughter can swing, really just so I can make it because I think it's going to be fun. But as always, I'd love to know what you guys are working on. Hit me up over on Instagram at the Make or Break Shop. Always looking for projects to showcase on the weekend edition of the show. So hit me up if you guys have built something cool as well. And as always, go make or break something in your shop. See you guys.